This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. The number to call to find help facing the mortgage crisis. Amy Roberts from the United Way's 211 service coming up in about 15 minutes. To begin with, Marianne Zalesnik has a look at this week's local headlines.
The city of Cincinnati this week promised to turn over detailed financial information to the attorneys of two unions suing the city. Bill Gustafson represents CODE, or Cincinnati Organized and Dedicated Employees. He says recent claims of a $28 million deficit, which forced hundreds of layoffs, don't jive with previous financial records. He'll have a forensic accountant compare them before an end-of-month hearing.
That then gives us an opportunity to evaluate the information, to prepare our witnesses, and to get ready for a hearing.
Gustafson had asked a judge to issue a temporary restraining order preventing the layoffs. City Solicitor John Kerb says Cincinnati must have a balanced budget by September 6th, and this court case could create some problems.
You know, every day that we go past September 6th will cost the city $37,000. So it's up to the manager to balance the budget. It's required by law that happen, and there's not an alternative to balancing the budget. So the longer this plays out, the more the delay, the more drastic the steps the city will have to take.
Kerb says implying the city really doesn't have a deficit just shows a complete lack of understanding of municipal financing and the economic conditions Cincinnati is in right now. The Hamilton County Coroner's Office was closed early in the week because of budget cuts, delaying autopsies in at least one criminal investigation. Coroner Odell Owens plans to shut down his office on 10 separate days through the end of the year to save money. Hamilton County commissioners have postponed until Tuesday a vote on placing three tax levies on the ballot. Commission President David Pepper wants to advance the issues for the Cincinnati Museum Center, MRDD, and Family Services and Treatment at lower millage amounts than the organizations are requesting. While he agrees with that, Commissioner Todd Portune asked for the extra time.
In at least trying to see to what degree, to a reasonable degree of certainty, we can maximize even better the resources that we will be asking of the general public, consistent with the policy you have presented.
In this tight economy, the commissioners are concerned if the levies propose a tax increase, voters won't approve them. Portune says if any one of them is defeated, it would be catastrophic for the county, the people it serves, and the broader community. Federal agents this week began rounding up 50 people indicted for being part of a Cincinnati-based scheme to arrange sham marriages to evade immigration laws. Fred Alverson is a spokesman for the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio.
There were earlier indictments back in May of some of the lieutenants, if you will, in this organization, but the people targeted in these arrests are the actual couples who were engaged in committing the sham marriages.
Alverson says Eastern Europeans who had overstayed their visas were recruiting U.S. citizens to marry them in an effort to obtain citizenship. He says the Cincinnati organization is the largest one federal authorities have dismantled as part of a marriage fraud investigation. Kings Island says it'll keep the troubled Son of Beast roller coaster shut down for the remainder of the summer season. Spokesman for the theme park, Don Helbig, says officials will decide the ride's future over the winter. The park closed the ride June 16th after a woman who rode the coaster reported she had been hospitalized with a burst blood vessel. Sharonville Mayor Virgil Lovett says the city is planning on breaking ground in October for an expansion of its convention center. Hamilton County commissioners made the next step possible by joining the city of Cincinnati using money from the hotel tax to partially fund the project. Commission President David Pepper stresses none of the money is coming from the county general fund.
We're all struggling with budgets and everything else. This is being paid for from the dollars that come through our hotel tax. And the theory has been, and I think it's working, that to take those dollars and invest them into things that actually grow that pie further makes all the sense in the world.
Officials are expecting all kinds of growth from the project. Commissioner Todd Portune sees more jobs and development coming from what he calls the anchor to the northern part of Hamilton County. Ohio State Fair officials say the annual event drew the highest attendance in 5 years as more than 86,000 people went through the gates. And that's the Week in Review. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Marianne Zalesnik.
Thank you.
Thanks for starting your Saturday with Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. On the Money this morning with Chris DeSimio is Declan O'Sullivan from the investment firm of Ball & Gaynor.
A busy week wrapped up on Wall Street yesterday, chock full of economic indicators the entire week. Productivity figures on Monday, better than expected. Trade deficit released the following day, smaller than expected. The Fed's Open Market Committee decision on Wednesday, no surprises there, though some of the text in that release did trigger a pretty vigorous rally on Wednesday that miraculously held through Thursday. Yesterday morning, we got a peek at inflation figures, core CPI, up 0.1%. The overall number, the headline number, unchanged from the prior session. So markets actually kind of hanging in there, though a little weak yesterday morning. It's a pleasure, though, to welcome back to the studio Mr. Declan O'Sullivan with the investment firm of Ball & Gaynor, a portfolio manager with many, many years of experience and a master's degree from the University of Dublin.
An engineering degree.
Engineering degree,
and
yes.
A master's degree from Columbia.
From Columbia University in Morningside Heights, New York City.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, Declan, you've written at your firm, Ball & Gaynor. You publish the market reviews, and you talk about animal spirits in your latest writing. What kind of animals are running around? Bulls, bears, or something in between?
Well, it's attributed to Sir John Maynard Keynes. He talked about the ability or the inclination of people to invest, and that requires animal spirits. It requires an enthusiasm to do things, even in spite of the risks that are in front of you. And he describes all economic activity as requiring a certain amount of exuberance, if you like, mm-hmm. To get it done. And animal spirits seems to have shown up in Wall Street because, you know, since the March low, the S&P 500 index is up 50%, which is quite a remarkable short-term move. And keep in mind that, you know, that's only 4 or 5 months ago.
Yeah.
And at that time, everybody was saying it's going lower.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. 5 months ago, yeah. Early March, the market was gripped by the animal in charge was the bear.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Now the bulls have certainly been running rampant. What would you expect then when we've had this vigorous advance? In fact, some have called it the strongest rally since in such a short period of time since the 1930s, since the late 30s. What can we as investors expect to see going forward? Will this trajectory continue? Will we have a powerful bull market that will continue? Yeah. Or are there elements beginning to creep into the marketplace that might argue for caution?
Just like it was 4 or 5 months ago, now when you read the information and the analysis, they're all saying it's going to go higher. You know, it really doesn't matter how low it gets, it's going to get lower. And no matter how high it gets, people will say it's going higher. So there's a fair amount of sentiment there, especially a lot of the readings of the technical analysts mm-hmm. say that it can go up another 15 or 20%. And perhaps it can, but we would be a little bit more cautious now because there are still a lot of things to be worked out in the economy. There are signs of a revival. The green shoots people, you know, keep
yes.
talking about signs of recovery every place. But it's still not sure. One of the reasons we believe that the stock market has gained so much is because of the enormous flood of money that the Federal Reserve has injected into the economy. Now, typically, the Fed will lower interest rates down to maybe 3 or 2% if in the case of a typical recession.
Right, they held them at zero last
year. Now, they've been holding it at zero now for at least 12 months. And then on top of that, they've gone into a thing called quantitative easing.
Which is
purchasing bucket loads of U.S. treasuries and mortgage securities. And that money is now in the system. It's mostly in banks and it's drifted into the mutual fund cash accounts and mm-hmm. so forth. So there's an awful lot of liquidity around. And it's earning nothing. And where the animal spirits comes in and say, somebody says, oh, gosh, there's no point in being in these things. Well, what else is there? Well, there's commodities, there's corporate bonds, and there's equities.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, there's, okay, let's do it. You know? And all of a sudden, you know, things pick up. And bingo, you know, momentum, and all of a sudden you're up 50%.
Yeah, you have a chart here on your, which of course doesn't really work well in radio, but it's a very elegant, elegantly simple two bar charts. There's the bar that shows that low quality stocks from the beginning of the year are up 11.2%, and through August 11th, high quality stocks were up 7.9%. In other words, there's about a 3%. Which is huge if you annualize that out, gap between in performance between low-quality and high-quality companies. First of all, how do you define low-quality versus high-quality, and then why is this gap so big?
Yeah, the division is based upon an S&P 500 ranking.
Okay.
And they rank the stocks from A's, that would be those would be high-quality stocks,
okay.
B's, C's, and so forth. So anything over a B is a higher quality, anything below those. So we simply just take all the below Bs and look at their return and compare those to the higher quality. And it happens that there's quite a big difference.
Yeah. So why?
And that's somewhat unexpected. And people would have thought that coming out of virtually a broken credit market system, that everybody would go to the securer,
Procter
& Gamble's and Exxon's and things like this. But in fact, that's why the animal spirits have turned up. And all of a sudden, we've forgotten, you know, that only 3 or 4 months ago, the world was coming to an end. And now we think there's endless prosperity ahead.
Yeah. Why is it then? This is one of the real conundrums, because as you just described, given what we've all been through in the last year and a half, it's hard to believe the market peaked out nearly 2 years ago. Uh-huh. October 9th of 2007 was the prior peak. Why is it then that the companies with rock solid balance sheets selling disposable or you know in the staples businesses, things that without which you cannot live, that pay rising dividends, you would think that those companies, I mean, logic would say that these are the companies that would lead the charge, that would, you know, like Charlton Heston as Moses parting the Red Sea and leading people to safety. And yet they have languished for the most part.
Yeah.
Why is that? And if it will change, when do you see that changing?
Well, keep in mind, it's a very short time frame. We're talking about 4 or 5 months.
Seems like forever.
But, you know, I think it will reverse it, because the lower quality stocks were clearly really undervalued at the worst of times. So people are looking to say, well, this is a real value opportunity for me. Whereas the Procter & Gamble's never quite got down that far. So they're not going to be bid up. But long term, that's where you want to be. The people who are running the stock market are not the people on Main Street. These gains have been all by the hedge funds and the Wall Street speculators, and based upon free money, basically, mm-hmm. and this enormous surge of liquidity, and the Federal Reserve has to start thinking about pulling that enormous increase in liquidity in, and they have to do it without jeopardizing an incipient economic revival. It's a very, very tricky step that the Fed has to do here. And on top of that, we have a political environment that's now favoring increased regulation of all business activities. And there's undoubtedly some tax increases on the way. So the outlook for economic growth, we're going to reduce the animal spirits, it seems.
they're going to be herded back into the pen, so to speak.
Right.
Declan, in the last 25 seconds or so that we have, what has to happen in your estimation and your experience for this rally? If it were to continue, what has to happen for it to continue?
You would definitely need to have a maintainable, a sustainable economic growth in the United States. And we're getting a fair amount of help from our overseas friends in China and India and places like that.
Okay.
And that is, if that can be sustained, then I think we can sustain this okay. place.
So keep an eye on those foreign shores and keep an eye on your own portfolio. And Declan O'Sullivan from Ball & Gainer, I want to thank you so much for being with us this Saturday morning.
Thank you very much.
For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Chris DeSimio on The Money.
Facing the Mortgage Crisis is a project of WVXU and CET as we try to inform and educate folks who are facing problems with their mortgages or with foreclosure. The next chapter features Amy Roberts. She's the director of United Way 211, joining me this morning to talk about the United Way 211 service. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Mark. Glad to be here.
Throughout the mortgage crisis, I've seen ads, heard ads, read ads, and everybody says United Way 211, dial 211. I imagine you've had quite a bit of traffic recently.
Yes, we have. In fact, even since last year, we've had a lot of traffic, too. It seems like the economy is really impacting everybody. And people who've never asked for help before are now reaching out.
Well, let me ask you, has this been taxing your resources? Has this been, making life a little interesting?
It's been making life very interesting. However, we've got a really good system set up where we've got trained call specialists. We have the information at our fingertips. We really want to make sure that we can get people to the right place at the right time the first time.
Now, what exactly is the 211 service?
211 is the easy three-digit number, like 911 is for emergencies and 411 is for directory assistance. 211 was dedicated over 5-6 years ago by the Federal Communication Commission to be the three-digit number to call for information and referral about community resources 24 hours a day. We're always there.
Now, these community resources weren't always necessarily focused on the mortgage crisis.
No. It could be anything from utility assistance, food, mentoring, anything health and human service related. We also have some community resources in there, such right now people are looking for school supplies. People can call us up. And if we have the information from the various community resources throughout our service area, we can ask people their zip code when they call up. And when we put that into our database, up will come resources closest to them. So people can call us to not only get help, but they can also call us to give help. So as this economy has affected people in a lot of different ways, there might be people interested in volunteer opportunities because they're transitioning and they want to keep their skills up and they want to keep networked. 211 can be a number to call to also look for different volunteer opportunities as well.
So a lot of help offered from the 211 service.
Yes.
So if I was having difficulty paying my mortgage, how does 211 help?
Well, people would dial 211, and what you would get would be a live person who will say, "Hi, thank you for calling United Way 211. How can I help you?" And people can start their story or give us a little bit of information, or sometimes people know exactly what they want, so they say, "Please give me the number 4." But it could be that somebody who may have had a job loss and is looking for assistance for their mortgage would call us up. We'd get a little bit of their information and ask a few questions, but primarily with their zip code, because they could be calling from Northern Kentucky, they could be calling from Claremont, Brown, Hamilton County, whatever. We want to make sure that we can get a resource that's close to them. And in our database, we have a list of agencies who have filled out our service profile so that they know that they're a trusted agency. We know that they're doing the service that they say they're doing as well.
So this is for people in what kind of geographical area?
Our geographical area that our United Way 211 serves is Hamilton, Claremont, and Brown in Ohio, in Boone, Kenton, and Campbell and Grant counties in Northern Kentucky.
Now, these operators are answering questions of many different types, but they're not necessarily mortgage counselors. They
correct.
Are making referrals, correct?
We connect people to needed resources, especially in mortgage assistance. And you make a good point because sometimes people think, well, if I call 211, they will help me with my payment or they will help me. But we are the connection to those trusted resources. So that's a good point. Thank you.
Yeah, just to clarify so that folks aren't hoping to get their mortgage problem
right.
solved, but you know who can help them.
That's correct. And even if we did get somebody calling up and saying, "I heard that you all can help me," which we do get that frequently, we can say, yes, we can provide some resources for you to call and connect with.
Now, I know a lot of people are apprehensive, maybe a bit scare-shy, if you may, when it comes to seeking help. When they dial 211,
what kind of process do they go through? How much do they have to be prepared? You know, what happens? You know, how can you relieve some of that fear?
So when people dial 211, you will get an automated attendant at the very beginning who says, thank you for calling United Way 211. Please press 1 for the next available call specialist. And within a very short period of time, a live person will pick up the phone. And it's a very warm and friendly voice because we know that people calling us up at any time, any day, are people who are seeking information and needing resources. So we want to be as open as we can. And if somebody calls up and all they say is, I heard you guys can help us, we'll say, well, sure. What exactly are you talking about? How can we help you? And then they might say, I've been out of work. This is the first time. I'm very worried about my family. I'm worried about my kids. We seem to be falling behind a little bit. What can you do? And then we'll ask a further question to say, well, in particular, what do you need help with? Is it a utility bill? Is it something for the children? And they might say, well, I'm really worried about my house. I'm behind in my bills, and I need help with my mortgage. And with that, we'll say, well, can we have your zip code, please? And once we have that, then we can find out what's going to be the most available resource for them as well. We can help with issues like affordable lending practices, mortgage assistance, refer people to consumer credit counseling. Perhaps there's maybe some legal advice that they're looking for, and a lot of different resources for foreclosure prevention. There's also resources for financial literacy, too. People might need help just helping get their bills and their credit in order, and there are those community resources out there. I really hope that when people do call 211, and again, they don't know what they're going to get because it could be they've already gone through other phone systems where they've had to be on hold for a long time or they've had to press 2 or 3 different numbers, and it can be frustrating. I know I recently called my insurance company and had to go through several steps to get to a live person to talk with, and I think that's one of the values that 211 has. Besides being there 24 hours a day, you're going to talk with a live person, and that helps relieve people. When they call, too, it's like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it's a live person. Thank you very much for talking and listening to me.
That relieves a little bit of the frustration sometimes. And
yes.
24 hours a day.
Yes. Weekends, evenings, we have our call specialists ready and willing and able to take your call.
Well, sometimes there's a little pride involved, too. Are the calls confidential?
Absolutely. The calls are free. There is no charge at all for people calling, and they are confidential. And on some of our callers, we will ask, would you mind if I call you up next week and see if you were able to access the resources I gave you? And if you're willing to give me your name and your phone number, let's set up a time and I'll call you back. And that's on just a random sample of the calls that we get.
Now, any suggestions you may have for a person having problems paying their mortgage? I've been, you know, with all the people, all the organizations we've been working with, it's a question I pose because everybody has a little bit of a different perspective on things. What is your advice?
My advice might be similar to what some of your other guests have said is please don't ignore your mail. Please respond. Please take an active role that if you feel you're falling a little behind in your bills and particularly your mortgage payment, take the action to talk with your lending institution and let them know the financial situation that they're in. People need to communicate with each other. You need to communicate with your family. And again, you mentioned pride. People may feel for the first time really bad that their finances are cut short. They're struggling. Who do they reach out to? I'm the breadwinner. I should be taking care of my family. And that's a very good point. And what we ask people is we certainly understand that. However, your family can help in this situation. They really need to know how frustrated you are. They need to know maybe the children need to curtail some of their expenses, and they'll need to know why they need to do that. And once families are informed, they can be a very solid unit in moving forward during these tough economic times. But particularly, don't sit on this. You need to take action and do something, whether it's call 211, call your bank, call one of the agencies that they may know of, maybe even through their church or faith organization. There might be some connections, too, with other organizations.
Well, thank you for the work you do, Amy.
Thank you very much.
Amy Roberts, the director of United Way 211. You can find more information about United Way 211 at our website, wvxu.org, or just give them a call. Get up. Get out in the woods. Take a hike. Tamara York, a local author, has just released 60 Hikes Within 60 Miles. She's in the studio with Andy Ellis to talk about her background and the new book.
First off, here you have a degree in wildlife management. You're a seasoned naturalist, and you obviously love hiking. When did you know that you wanted to dedicate your life to nature and the outdoors?
I'd always been an outdoors person. When I was growing up as a kid, I spent a lot of time on my grandparents' farm, a lot of time hiking one of the hikes in the book, which is called the Schrader Weaver Woods. And I always had that love of nature, but I never realized when I was a child that you could actually translate that when you got to college into a career. So I started out in pharmacy, and I absolutely did not like being inside of buildings, and went and took a class in natural resources management and quickly changed my mind. And that pretty much changed the rest of my life.
And how many years have you been a naturalist?
17.
And what exactly does that entail?
Teaching people about nature and about the connections between them and nature and the connections in nature. So it might be something as simple as explaining that, you know, a sycamore tree, as it grows and dies, you have all these nooks and crannies that create homes for different wildlife, anything from squirrels to great horned owls. And up further north, you can have ospreys or eagles even nesting in a sycamore tree. And sometimes people don't realize that, you know, there's a really diverse system just right in your own backyard.
Well, okay. Now, about the book. We should talk about the book at least
maybe,
a little bit.
Maybe, just a little bit.
Was it difficult to find 60 hikes within 60 miles of Cincinnati?
It was actually difficult narrowing it down to the 60 that I would recommend to
really?
Somebody else. Because it's within 60 miles of the Beltway around Cincinnati. So there's a little bit more space out there. It goes as far over as Harding Lake in Indiana, as far south as Quiet Trails down in Kentucky, and as far north as like the Clifton Gorge, John Bryan area of Ohio. So it was a matter of narrowing it down to the hikes that I would truly recommend to a friend of mine. Say, you know, you really should go hike this. If you want to go on this type of hike, this is someplace you really should look at going.
And how much help did you need, and where did that help come from?
Well, my brother was a great help. He was my 2 a.m., how do you make this GPS thing do this call? Because a lot of the stuff when you're transferring the GPS information to a mapping system, there's a lot of technical difficulties with that. So he was very helpful on the tech side. But as far as help finding the hikes, the Tri-State Hiking Group was great. What I did is I had emailed everybody that I knew in the natural resources realm that I knew that liked hiking or liked spending time outdoors, and said, what are your favorite hikes? And looked to see if there was any that I hadn't heard of before, and then went back and picked their brains about, well, why did you like that hike? Why was it good? And then actually went out and hiked several of those hikes.
Are there many kid-friendly or family-friendly hikes?
There are actually quite a few. Cincinnati, a lot of people don't realize how great Cincinnati is. It's just a tremendous area. There's a huge amount of diversity just here in this tiny little area. This used to be an area that was an ocean millions and millions of years ago. And so you have all these cool Ordovician age fossils that the kids can find on several of the hikes. Most of the hikes, actually there's a big list in the front of the book of all the hikes that are kid-friendly hikes. Pretty much you can read into that as hikes without cliffs.
Okay. A little safer.
A little safer, yeah. They fall down, it's only going to be a couple feet. So that's what I did, is, you know, pulled out hikes that were good for kids to go on, pulled out hikes that were good for adults to go on that were, you know, had a little bit more challenge to them. For example, one hike that is quite a challenge is Clifty Falls hike, and there's a trail that goes through the bottom, and it's the number two trail. It's very difficult to do, and it's a long trail. And then when you get down to the bottom, the joke we have in our family is the problem with going downhill is you have to just go back up to get to wherever you just came from. The quote-unquote problem with Clifty is you go downhill, and you go in this gorgeous ravine, and then you look back up, and you're like, yeah, I got to go back up. So it's a hike that you could do with kids, but you have to plan an entire day, whereas a lot of hikes you want to do with kids, especially young ones, you want to introduce them to something that's very simple for them to do. So maybe a 2 mile hike where you take several breaks along the way, just to kind of give them a chance to explore and a chance to enjoy themselves outdoors. But if you are hiking with kids, don't do it like, okay, we got to get this hike done in the next 15 minutes because you're just going to wind up frustrated and pulling your hair out.
Well, in relation to that, I've read a couple articles that talk about how society is, quote, plugged in now. Do you think that the appreciation of nature is suffering because of all the technology that's available that now can just keep you inside all day?
Well, I think you can see that in several realms, and there are several action groups that have been started to address that. You have an increase in childhood obesity. You have kids who, when I was a naturalist, you have kids who are just terrified of going into the woods. Mm-hmm. It's this mysterious, dark, you know, dangerous place. And the woods is a great place to go and explore. What we did a lot of times with when I was out with my girls hiking is, when the cicadas were coming out in full force, we went out really early in the morning to see them come out of the ground, and we'd flip over the leaves and watch them dry out. And it was just that slowing down of the pace and really bringing them into to connect. Because, kids, they have so much stimulation, the video games and everything is really fast-paced, and it's too much for them to handle sometimes. And you take them out of that element, put them back in a natural element where they can really slow down and enjoy what's around them and really appreciate the simple things in life. Watching a cicada dry on the bottom of the leaf, you can't get much simpler than that. Here in Cincinnati, too, that we have a great group called the Leave No Child Inside Greater Cincinnati. And they've done a tremendous amount of work on getting kids outdoors. You have the Great Outdoor Weekend, which is coming up in September. And that's another thing to get people out and to get them to really realize that there are just tons of recreational opportunities just right here in Cincinnati. You don't have to go out west. You don't have to go to a mountain range. We have it all right here in Cincinnati.
What was the best part of writing the book, the best experience that you had?
Technically, there are two, and they happened on the same day. In the morning, I went and hiked Schrader Weaver Woods, which I talked about earlier, which is the technical name for it, is the Schrader Weaver State Nature Preserve. I hiked there, and there were several inches of snow on the ground, and there's nothing going on. It's an agriculture community, so unless you're going out when they're planting or they're harvesting, it's very, very quiet, very still. It was actually so quiet, I could hear my own heart beating in my ears.
Wow.
So where else are you going to get that? That's just impossible to find anywhere else. Then the next place, this is over near Connersville, Indiana. The next place was south of Connersville at the Mary Gray Bird Sanctuary, and the coolest thing there was I came around the corner and I was fiddling with my GPS unit trying to figure out how to get this waypoint thing done. And as I came around the corner, there's the nice big open prairie and there are two coyotes. And the coyotes are pouncing on something underneath the snow. And these huge, just billowy flumes of snow are coming up out off the ground as the coyotes are pouncing on the ground. And I watched them play for several minutes before, well, they probably weren't playing, but I watched them dine, I guess, for several moments before they realized I was even there. And that was just such a cool opportunity. I mean, where do you get to see that at? It was just really, really nice, chance just to connect with nature and really enjoy the outdoors. And that was like one of the coldest days of the year, and it was snowing. And it's most days where people would be like, are you crazy to go hiking now?
Yep.
The thing that's neat with hiking when the weather is quote-unquote bad is there are a lot of other people out hiking. So, and I mentioned in the book, unless it's like a thunderstorm with a lot of lightning and stuff like that, go out because there won't be hardly anybody else on the trail. And especially rainstorms are the best to go hiking in because you get to see so much more wildlife. The wildlife doesn't go inside and flip on the TV
exactly.
set. They're still going about their day. So you get to see a lot more wildlife.
Well, of the 60 hikes, what would be the top few that you have to recommend that people have to go and hike?
I would say, of course, like I'll keep promoting Schrader Weaver. Schrader Weaver, and then you would have Clifton Gorge, which is Clifton Gorge and John Bryan sit along the same gorge area. Then I would say Clifty Falls would be another one that would be great to go to. And, of course, the creme de la creme around this area is the Cincinnati Nature Center. They have great hiking trails. They have a wonderful nature program. Their naturalists are top drawer, the great naturalist. And there's so much activity and things for the kids to do to connect with nature there. You know, we go and often, I go playing on Spain in just a few hours and we wind up, having to go, okay, it's time to go home for dinner. We wind up spending most of the day there.
Well, and finally, the descriptions of the trails offer so much detail in the book. How long did it take to just sit down and describe with so much detail each of these trails?
Thank you. From start to finish for the entire book, from the time I signed the contract to the time the book was published was 2 years. And what I did is along the trails, as I was marking the waypoints along the trails about where unique things were and what was really cool about the trail, I was also keeping notes. I don't tend to do things the same way every time. So sometimes it'd be on a piece of paper, or sometimes it'd be on a video or a voice recorder. And sometimes it would be, I'd be doing it on my BlackBerry and emailing myself.
Walking down the trail.
Walking down the trail, BlackBerry. Yeah. So it was just a series of things and like different things I wanted to capture for people and show them what great variety we have here. Most people think, the Midwest, Snoozeville, it's not that exciting. There's no mountain ranges. There's none of these great vistas. And there's actually we've got some really, really great places to go and see wildlife and see the different types of trees that we have. Plus, we get the advantage. We have all four seasons.
Yes, we do.
So there's a lot of color in the fall. You've got your spring wildflowers, of course, in the springtime. And the spring wildflower show goes on from, late February, early March, all the way into June. And, you can follow the trilliums around, the Dutchman britches and the trout lilies. So there's a lot of variety if you just slow down and take time to see it.
I've been speaking with Tamara York, author of the book 60 Hikes Within 60 Miles. Tamara, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Andy Ellis.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. Before the Cincinnati Post went out of existence, Josh Katsowitz was the writer on the University of Cincinnati Sports Beat. He's in the front row with Betsy Ross to discuss his new book, Bearcats Rising.
University of Cincinnati Bearcat football team still living off the glow of its Orange Bowl appearance this past bowl season. But now, of course, it's time to lace them up and do it all over again. Prove that the 2008 Big East championship season was no fluke. And there's a new book out that chronicles not just that season, but really the history of the program and what led the team eventually to that Orange Bowl appearance. It is called Bearcats Rising, Rags to Riches, How a Gridiron Minority Bludgeons Its Way into the Big Time. Author is Josh Katsowitz, and he is here with us on the front row. Josh, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Betsy.
You seem to have unprecedented access to players, former players, coaches, former coaches. First of all, where did the idea for the book come from, and how did you get UC to really buy into it?
It wasn't difficult to get UC to buy into it because it was mostly going to be a positive look at how they, went from being so mediocre to being so good. So that wasn't really a tough sell, especially with a guy like, Brian Kelly, the coach, who's very media savvy, mm-hmm. and really knows how to play the game and knows what kind of positive things can come from something like this. So that wasn't difficult. Kind of the genesis of the idea was 2007, they were playing at Rutgers. Both teams were undefeated. Both teams were in the top 25. And it just felt like such a new experience for me because I had lived in Cincinnati at that point for about 4 years, and I had never seen any kind of interest in college football like I had seen in 2007. And I'm from Atlanta, and I went to the University of Georgia, and college football is so huge down there. Mm-hmm. And comparatively speaking, it just, when I first got here, it was a shock to me that nobody really seemed to care about, you know, Cincinnati football. Yeah, I could really feel the tide turning, I guess, and I could feel, you know, all of a sudden there were students lining up for tickets, which I don't think had ever happened before, and they were undefeated and they were getting national attention, and it just seemed like, wow, there's something really kind of cool going on here. Maybe it's something that we can document, and it'd be a good story to tell.
Before we talk about the present-day Cats, let's talk about the program history. And I think it is very impressive. If you're not familiar with the school and its history in football, the names that have come through Clifton over the years. I mean, you go back to Sid Gilman and Saban and Gottfried and Watson Brown, the assistants, many of whom are in the NFL right now, Rex Ryan and Harbaugh and Mike Tomlin. And it is amazing the people who have come through Clifton. And, of course, the guy who wrote the foreword for it is Urban Meyer.
Right. It's pretty amazing. I didn't, you know, when I first kind of came up with this idea with my publisher, Orange Fraser, they had said, okay, well, you know, you're gonna talk about the history, right, because there's a lot of history. And I said, well, there's a lot of history, but it's not very good history. But because on the surface, they've been, you know, mediocre at best. Mm-hmm. For most of the program's history. But when you go back and look and see who Rick Minner has as assistant coaches, I mean, he's got three guys in the NFL right now. Mm-hmm. And you got even Urban Meyer. I mean, Urban Meyer didn't have much of an impact when he was here, but you see, you know, the heights he's risen to. It's really impressive. And just guys on the periphery that maybe you wouldn't even think about them having been here. I mean, Jim Tressel could have had a job here possibly. And it's just the outlying fringes, you know, of his existence, the people who are kind of around for a little bit, it is pretty striking. And it's like, and you wonder, with all this, you know, talent that came through here, why were they so mediocre for so long? It's kind of an interesting question.
Well, talk a little bit about the Jim Tressel story, because I didn't know it until I read it in the book. Talk about how close he came to being a Bearcat.
You know, that was a really down time for the program. Tim Murphy had just left after he had one win season, and he went to Harvard, took a 40% pay cut to go to Division I AA school. So that kind of tells you where the program was and how people thought of its chances of becoming some sort of powerhouse. There was no chance. That's what people thought. The one person that was kind of making a name for himself was Jim Tressel, who was at Youngstown State, had won a national championship there. And there were some people who wanted to look at him and could see him as a potential solid Division I coach. You know, the president ended up going with Rick Minner because he came from Notre Dame and he had that glitz and that prestige. And really, nobody knew who Jim Tressel was at the time. Mm-hmm. What Jim Tressel told me was that he didn't really admit to that he had interviewed, but he had talked to people, and there was certainly some interest on both sides. The main sticking point was that Youngstown State was about ready to play for their second national title, and Tressel didn't want to interview or really officially speak to anybody until the season was over, I mean, understandably. And UC didn't want to wait. So UC goes after Rick Minner, and Jim Tressel plays his championship game on Saturday, wins it with Youngstown State, and then I think on Sunday they announced Rick Minner as a new head coach. And Tressel told me and said, listen, if they'd waited an extra day or two, there certainly would have been some interest there. Mm. So, you know, as a UC, if you're a UC fan, you hear that, you think, wow, I mean, what could have been if Jim Tressel was coaching the team in 1994? It could have been completely different.
Oh, I know. What could have been? We are talking with Josh Katsowitz on his new book on UC football, Bearcats Rising. You mentioned Rick Minter, and that really seems to be the turning point of this franchise, if you will. The things stabilized, and they started to make progress on the field and off. That's the plus side of Rick Minter. But then reading some of the interviews, especially with some of the players, he was not necessarily beloved by the players and had the stigma of just having turnover in his assistant ranks.
It's a contradiction, really. You know, I've talked to some people who've already read the book today So I was talking to a buddy yesterday, and he said, yeah, I think you were too easy on Rick Minner.
Oh.
There were a lot of people who did not like the Rick Minner era. And it was interesting for me having to write it because I thought that he deserved credit for helping turn a program around and putting that kind of the first layer of concrete on the foundation. But he was not popular with his players. He was not popular with his assistant coaches. He went through 55 of them in 10 years, which is amazing. I don't know how you can run a program if you keep losing five assistants every year.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many people who I try to talk to about UC and about Rick Minner who did not want to talk to me about it. There was a couple guys, there was one guy in particular who said, I do not want to have anything to do with UC. So that's how, and this is a guy who played, I mean, played and played well and during that time frame. So it's, there's still some hurt feelings for what I, you know, 15 years later, there's still hurt feelings. So there, I had to balance that, that kind of, still that blood boiling part for some people with the fact that Minner did things that, and to really turn this program around, brought him to the first bowl game in 47 years. You know, they had some good seasons under Minner. Ultimately, Bob Goin, the athletic director at the time, decided he wasn't going to be the guy that could take him to that next level, to the Big East. But there's no question in my mind that he deserves a lot of credit for mm-hmm. where they are today. I'm not sure that Mark D'Antonio comes here if Rick Minner hadn't done some good things, and I know Brian Kelly wouldn't have been here. It just so happens that he's not a popular guy. And, you know, I talked to Rick Minner for 4 hours about all this stuff, and he defended himself and, you know, said what he thought, but there are people that still are not very entranced by his personality, I guess. Mm.
So he put down the foundation. As you mentioned, D'Antonio then comes in. D'Antonio's a Big Ten guy. He came in here. He had it in the back of his mind. I think everybody kind of realized that he would someday return to the Big Ten. So he does. So he goes to Michigan State. And so now you got to hire yet another coach. This revolving door comes in, and up pops Brian Kelly, not necessarily off the radar screen because he had interviewed for some big-time jobs.
Yeah, he'd interviewed at Iowa State and at Michigan State, and D'Antonio beat him out for that Michigan State job. He didn't get the other one. But yeah, Brian Kelly, he was somewhat known. He was really well-known on the Division II level because he had been so good at Grand Valley State and then had gone to Central Michigan, which was in complete and utter turmoil, and had begun to turn that program around as well. So there was certainly some good vibes coming off of him. But, you know, Brian Kelly came in, and he wasn't some new guy. He had been a head coach for 15 or 16 years, and he knew what he was doing, knew how to, like I said, he knew how to play the game with the media and with, you know, the people he interviewed with. And he really is just, he's been a breath of fresh air. There's never been a UC coach like him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could talk about Sid Gilman and his coaching acumen and how great he was here and how great he became in the NFL. You could talk about a guy like Tony Mason in the mid-70s who was very personable and really got people interested in the couple years that Tony Mason was here. But Brian Kelly is almost a combination of those two because he has the coaching acumen, he's proved that, and he has the personality to get people excited. And UC needed somebody like that in order to turn this program around. I mean, I think if Mark D'Antonio was still here, I'm not sure this would have happened. Mark D'Antonio, nice guy, really good coach, not the kind of personality that's going to bring 35,000 people into Nippert Stadium on a weekly basis. I think him leaving for Michigan State really kind of turned into a good thing for UC, even though at the time it didn't really seem like it.
I think, and everybody says that Brian Kelly gets it. That's kind of the universal label. He gets it. But what is it that he gets? I mean, he's here on campus, and a couple of months later, he's calling out the Cincinnati Inquirer for not sending a reporter.
And the Post.
And the Post, that's true. To media day. I mean, for a brand new rookie coach, that takes a little moxie to do that. I mean, what is it that you see that he gets?
He's just kind of the complete package. He didn't understand this at first, but he understands that as the coach of a Division I school, you have to be the CEO. It's not just about coaching the guys up on the practice field. It's not just about scheming for the opponent on Saturday, not about X's and O's. It's about everything. It's about media. It's about getting people out. It's about, you know, going out and talking to people and getting them excited. It's the whole culmination of everything.
Okay, so Orange Bowl, BCS Bowl, who'd have thunk? UC in the BCS. Well, here they are. So now it's 2009. How do you do it all over again?
Well, that's a good question. What I've learned dealing with Brian Kelly and researching his career and his life, it's not really a good idea to count him out. So when people say, well, they lose 10 starters on defense, and oh, they're probably not going to be as good, and maybe they're going to be the fourth best team in the Big East, those predictions never seem to work out when you're talking about Brian Kelly. So even though they lose 10 starters on defense, the guys they have replacing, you know, these former starters are guys who've been around the program for the last 3 and 4 years. They understand the concepts and they buy into his concept is next man in. If this guy is gone or if this guy is injured, the backup next man in. And as cliche as that kind of sounds, at least to us jaded media hacks, they buy into that. He's very good at getting his players to buy into that. So I think that's not going to be a problem. I think they're going to be with, you have a guy like Tony Pike at quarterback. Mm-hmm. You have some good receivers. You have a defense that will continue to get better through the season. They could, again, play for a Big East title.
The book is Bearcats Rising, Rags to Division I Riches, How a Gridiron Minority Bludgeons Its Way into the Big Time. You'll be signing later on this coming week?
I have a book signing on Thursday over at Joseph Beth at 7 p.m. That's the big kickoff. We have some special guests that'll be there, some former players. And I have one next Sunday, which would be with the 23rd. August 23rd over at Barnes & Noble on Fields Ertle Road.
Excellent. And if you want more information on the book, you can go to wvxu.org. It's a fascinating book. I tell you what, it was a special season, and you're right. You could certainly feel the electricity and the magic in that stadium that you've never felt before, and it was a lot of fun. Let's hope they can do it again. Josh Katsowitz, thank you for being with us on the Front Row.
Thanks, Bessie. I appreciate it.
Coming up on Sunday's Cincinnati Edition, why are highly creative people more prone to addiction and mental illness? Dr. Ann Paris explores the issue. She's a clinical psychologist and author of the book Standing at Water's Edge. A look at the history of the Ohio legislature and its journey from governing a territory to becoming a state government. Thane Maynard's guest Glenn Sobotka talks about outdoor fun for the visually impaired. And how does sunscreen affect the environment? Sunday's Cincinnati Edition, beginning tomorrow morning at 7 on 91.7 WVXU. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Bruce Ellis, with assistance from Chelsea Vandedrink, Kevin Rowinski, and Andy Ellis. I'm Mark Purcell, the executive producer and host of Cincinnati Edition. Thanks for listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. It's 8 o'clock.